Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. We've got This Week in Law coming up. Evan Brown, Jason Sweet, and Marty Schwimmer are here with me, and we've had some really fun discussions on deck for you. We're going to talk a lot about copyright reform. We're going to figure out if Fox knows exactly who they're messing with and if it really matters. We've got lots of trademark stuff with Marty Schwimmer, who's an expert in that field. Plus, we'll touch base with Jason's on-the-ground experiences there in Boston and consider the social media ramifications of what went down last week, too. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 208, recorded April 26, 2013. The Devil Wears Prenda. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWIL. And by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWIL. Hey, folks, I'm Denise Howell, and this is This Week in Law. We've got a great panel of folks for you this week to talk about everything that's happening in the world of technology and law. Jason Sweet from the law firm of Boot Sweet. Let me start that again. Boot Sweet. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We've got an excellent panel of folks here today to talk about everything related to technology and law, the latest and greatest developments in that area. Joining us once again is Jason Sweet of Booth Sweet in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you too.
You're living in one of the hot spots of the world these days. Have they let you out and about?
Yeah, it's I guess it's a little scary. I don't know. But our office is actually one street over from where the brothers had an apartment. So,
frightening. Were you in the office that day?
No, they closed everything down. Businesses, everyone was told to stay home.
Yeah. My husband, being the workaholic that he sometimes can be, was watching the coverage of all that from out here where we live on the West Coast and going, I would certainly be in the office. There's no way they would be keeping me at home. I'm like, really? Okay, then. Also joining us is Marty Schwimmer from New York, New York. Hello, Marty.
Hey, Denise. How are you?
Doing great. Good to see you again.
Good to be seen.
Marty, of course, of the Trademark Blog. Longtime friend and friend of the show. So wonderful to chat with you again. And Evan Brown, fresh off hosting last week's show, which I think is, I still haven't finished it, but it's one of my favorite, if not my favorite episode of this show ever. So if you haven't caught TWiL 207 with Ryan Kahlo and Ryan Davidson and James Daly, go check it out. Evan, well, you did such a great job, and it's great to see you again.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I really enjoyed hosting the show. And like I was saying before, we got on the air, started recording. I really can't take much credit for the success of last week's show. Those were just brilliant guys, really fun to talk with. And, you know, we could just throw out all practicality and just get totally hypothetical, both when it comes to technology and law. So it was a great time. But I'm really happy to be back this week as well. I'm looking forward to our conversation here. Great to see you again, Marty and Jason. Looking forward to our conversation here.
The other thing I so enjoyed about last week's show is here I thought I was leaving you with a panel that you were just going to have oodles of fun with because of the subject matters that they're conversant in, robots and laws of things like comic books and superheroes and fantasy worlds. And then the events we were just discussing transpired, and there was really no way that you could get around talking about those things last week. And you guys did so well. The coverage and discussion of the privacy issues and the security issues that you guys went through, particularly with Ryan at the beginning of the show. Of all the coverage I saw of the events unfolding, and you kind of couldn't pull yourself away from it, it was so refreshing to have just a really reasoned, not time constrained. I think that makes such a huge difference. Sure. When smart people aren't being cut off because they've got to go to commercial. So I was just really impressed and with the quality of what you guys did. So hats off to you.
Thanks a
lot. Can I ask a question?
Sure. Okay.
How many of you guys last Friday listened or used Twitter while you were following the events, especially the ones of Friday evening?
I was at a wedding, in another kind of frame of mind. So, I checked during the wedding to see what was going on, but, I wasn't on Twitter.
So Friday night is when they caught Jokar, right? That's right. What you're talking about. Like when that stuff was unfolding.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's a general question, but specifically Friday. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of an hour period of any of last week where I wasn't checking in with Twitter. And, so much news broke first there. I mean, even, going all the way back to Monday, I was hearing about it on Twitter, at least a half hour before mainstream media was covering it. And then, of course, there was a lot of noise, a lot of misinformation throughout the week. It's probably one of the weeks since I've been on Twitter since however many years that, I probably used it more last week than any other since joining.
So what about you, Jason?
Whenever something like this happens, I tend to ignore most media outlets because at that point, nobody really knows all the facts. So, like Evan pointed out, there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I prefer to be informed after everything's been filtered. I didn't even know that there had been a bombing until an hour or two after someone called me and asked if I was okay. And I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah. I had no idea.
Right. Well, that one of the stories I wanted to talk about today was Jokar Tsarnaev's use of social media and how a couple of points. The less interesting of the two is how much the media seems to be trying to make hay and psychologically analyze his various social media accounts to try and draw out, whatever tidbits of intellectual insight into this person's psyche you can glean from there. So there's been a lot of that. But what I found fascinating was the fact that he was tweeting after the explosions and before, up until very close to when he was apprehending. And, I kept thinking of lawyers at Twitter and Facebook and elsewhere where he may have had accounts that must have been, right there with their finger on the number of the DOJ to be able to call in or tweet them and say, hey, this person has tweeted again, who you are looking for, because that certainly could have helped them locate someone. And apparently he was savvy enough once they were actively searching for him not to do that. But I don't know that every suspect would be. Were you guys paying attention to that at all, Evan?
I wasn't even aware of this account of that apparently was his until just yesterday when we were starting to, prepare for the show here. So, as a general observation of it, though, I think it's really it's probably pretty easy to overstate the importance of what somebody on the run like him would be doing using social media. Clearly, it's a little bit of a glimpse into probably, very unhelpful in figuring out precisely what he was doing. At least the actual data would be the metadata, maybe more interesting, the location information, stuff like that.
Right.
But I think that the fact that he's doing this, the fact that he was trying to obfuscate a little bit, he's like put out that tweet that said "Ain't no love in the heart of the city" or something like that, goofy. On the day of the bombing, that just yeah, that's kind of interesting. It's kind of novel, but you know, we don't need this to tell us that he was an idiot anyway, you know?
Right. No, I was thinking of it more as a law enforcement tool. I suppose if he'd used his phone at all, they would have been able to triangulate something from that, presuming they had that information. Marty, any thoughts on this?
Well, I note that Friday evening there were several fake Jokar Twitter accounts, and they were just giving all sorts of misinformation. I think right now in Hollywood, I'm sure that there's screenplays making the rounds where it's about the latest sociopathic killer who's live blogging his mm-hmm. events.
Yeah, and the flip side of that, I mean, there probably is some good Hollywood material in these terrible events. But what wasn't good Hollywood material was the, I don't know if it was an arraignment, but the hearing where he was brought in and read his Miranda rights finally. And, you know, what struck me about that was just how cut and dried and boring and bland and by the book it was. And someone on Google Plus posted the transcript of it and said, you know what, as dry as this is, it makes me proud to be an American. And I felt exactly the same way. You know, you don't want drama in that kind of situation. You want people's rights to be recognized and implemented. And that's exactly what happened there. Jason, you know, you're right there on the ground where all these events happened. Any thoughts on either the social media angle or the now prosecution of the suspect?
In terms of the social media, I'm not really surprised he was tweeting, given his age. Mm-hmm. It seems to be something that, you know, I don't want to say the younger generation, but, you know, people who grow up with this, Facebook and whatnot, they put a lot of stuff out there that they don't really think about. And, you know, it's amazing that in a lot of the cases I handle, what I can glean off of people's, you know, tweets or unsecured Facebook pages. It's the stuff they put out there, and they don't really seem to think anything about it or how it'll come back to bite them. And Marty, I heard that in addition to the rounds of screenplays going around, I think Zoe Deschanel has been confirmed to play one of the bombers.
It would be a very upbeat and perhaps musical version of the events in that case. All right. Well, as long as we're on the subject of Boston and the events there, we do have a trademark angle on that as well. The Boston Strong trademark. Apparently, a couple of people have tried to register. Our trademark guru, Marty, do you have any thoughts on this?
I think you ask me this kind of question every couple of years. I think the last time was shock and awe. That uh-huh. was when, look, there's two basic misconceptions why people rush to do this. One of them, the article that's in the show notes makes the point that once it's out there to this extent, it cannot function as a trademark. So no one's really going to be able to say that they are the one source of Boston Strong. And the other one is a misunderstanding of how these expressions are used. So that if I have a T-shirt and it says Boston Strong, I'm not saying this is the Boston Strong brand. I am merely communicating something with that T-shirt. In other words, it's not a trademark. It's decorative use. So this is the typical story after an event like this, that these applications will die a quiet death.
Well, and the image we just flashed on the video from your blog is interesting, too, because it uses the Red Sox logo over Strong. So different trademark ramifications there.
Well, I think the Red Sox clearly licensed that use. I mean, that symbol was very prominent at the very moving ceremony Saturday afternoon. So licensed use.
There we go. Alrighty then, let's stay on a couple of other crimes and justice and security related issues. Another thing that happened a couple of weeks ago that I've been wanting to discuss is this researcher who was at a security conference in Amsterdam who demonstrated something that he calls Planesploit, which is his exploitation of various vulnerabilities in old avionics technology that didn't anticipate being exploited in this way. You know, the systems of a plane that don't relate perhaps directly to navigation or communication, but could be used to access those systems and then control the plane. The guy claims he could go in and control the plane's destination and make the plane move in various ways using his Android handset. So actually, Steve Gibson did a great rundown and explanation, as is his very great expertise, on his show last week of all this for anybody who missed that and is looking for more details. But I'm interested in the sort of legal, ethical angle and getting your guys' take on this. Obviously, it's very scary that this could be done, and various aviation regulators are working with this person to find out exactly, you know, what was being exploited. On the one hand, it's wonderful that they have this information and can close these holes. And I don't think he did anything that people are saying is reckless by releasing, you know, how exactly this could be done. But the fact that it can be done is now known widely. And Evan, do you think that's a problem?
Well, it presents an interesting issue. And it's, I mean, from what I gather in this situation here, as you observed, Denise, it doesn't look like the guy did anything wrong because he was getting secondhand software and hardware and wasn't actually jeopardizing the security of an airline management system by doing this test. But he did exploit and make known a security vulnerability, I guess. I assume that it is valid. What he's saying is true. It seems a little far-fetched that you could crash an airplane sitting just using your Android phone, but I suppose it's plausible. It could happen. I think the real issue is probably more of an ethical one. And this motif has come up a couple of times all the way back on episode 84, which was in October of 2010. On this show, we talked about Fire Sheep and whether or not it's ethical for, you know, a white hat hacker sort to exploit this and to actually, perhaps violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in the name of doing this. And then even more recently, we talked about Weave's conviction and sentencing and, you know, the things that he did with exploiting vulnerabilities with iOS and all this. So this one here sounds like it, from a legal standpoint, might be the least problematic legally, because I don't see any facts here that support a claim that he actually did anything legally wrong, like I said, violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or even, heaven forbid, violated the terms of service of something here. This seems to be like it was done more in a laboratory or something like that, if you know what I mean. So I think the real question, or probably where the most meaningful discussion can be had about this is in the terms of whether this is right or wrong. And then, of course, we can go all over the place on that. That's probably where, you know, given the ability and that's probably not the exact right term, but the ability to crowdsource more of this security vulnerability searching, that's probably the question of, you know, how are we going to develop norms about whether or not this is right or wrong to do this kind of stuff.
What do you think, Marty?
I have no insight on this. This is all news to me. What did he say? Did he say what his motivation was?
Simply to be able to show that this could be done, and certainly as a warning, he did not do this in any sort of threatening way. His name is Hugo Tesso, and he was presenting at the Hack in the Box Security Summit in Amsterdam. And he demonstrated that he could take control of aircraft flight systems and communications using an Android smartphone and some specialized attack code. This is from the Register article. And all of our discussion points, you can look at this over at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/208. Also, if you listen to, I think it was episode 400, congratulations, Steve, on episode 400 of Security Now, from about minute 35 until the early 40 minutes, he went through this in some detail. So take a look at that if you'd like a bit more information on it. But yeah, his idea here, Marty, it seemed to me, was just to go to the conference and have a sensational presentation, which he did. Certainly, this is something that has a lot of people concerned.
The Packeteer in IRC, I mean, I think he did not use the sarcasm tag or the facetious tag, but he said, you see, if not for this white hat hacker disclosing it, a criminal would never think of such a thing. I think there's some sarcasm in that, but and I get the point is, you know, why should we be so concerned that he has done that, has disclosed this? Because, you know, it's not like criminals weren't trying to do this already, or terrorists, if you will, weren't trying to do this already. So that's probably a net positive that it has been disclosed and that attention has been drawn to it, and that avionics security, those who are in charge of avionics security now have more of a public relations reason, if anything, to solve problems like that. It's what I think what Packeteer is saying. Sure, I'm reading a lot into that and making a lot of assumptions, but in any event, that could be a valid observation from somebody's perspective, I guess.
That's our job, Evan. Keep it up.
Right.
Jason, what do you think? Should this have been done or no?
I just don't quite understand the point, given that this is one of the reasons we actually have pilots on the planes and they're not automatically flown. You know, and the article even touches on that, saying that the pilots can only override any automated systems. Any computer system can be hacked into and made to do things. So, in fact, they made a little movie about it with Johnny Lee Miller and Angelina Jolie back in 92. But, you know, or you could go as far back as War Games, you know, let's throw in some Matthew Broderick.
Angelina Jolie was in War Games?
No, just Matthew
Hackers.
She was in Hackers. They're computers. People can hack into them.
What causes me concern in this particular instance, if what Hugo demonstrated can actually be done, is yes, pilots can override things, but how do they know if they're being fed bad information? You know, if they're getting something from their navigation system that they don't know is incorrect.
They could look out the window.
Yeah, they could. But that doesn't always help when you're at 75,000 feet or if they fly that high. I don't think they do that.
I don't think quite so much.
No, I don't think so. You're brushing up against space. In any event, it piqued my interest. It definitely made me want to make my pilot friends aware of this if they weren't already, and make sure that they can, you know, have good conversations with their employers about whether the avionics in their planes need to be reviewed or not. So that was my thought on that one. Let us move on and talk about, this is something that comes up quite a bit. People email the show a lot and ask about it. Someone did just last week. So it's nice that we have the opportunity to discuss the turning over of passwords needed to decrypt a hard drive. If you are a suspect, sometimes this comes up when people are detained by airports for security reasons. In this particular case, this was in Wisconsin? Yes. In Wisconsin, a person suspected of having child porn on his hard drive was asked to decrypt the contents of several hard drives, actually. And the judge found here that actually invoking the Fifth Amendment was okay, and that he did not have to turn over the passwords because doing so would then confirm that he, in fact, you know, was the manager of those hard drives, and that would be evidence against him in the case. You know, presumably he and his lawyers are arguing, hey, never saw those things. Not mine, not my stuff. So if you can decrypt them, if you're ordered to decrypt them, that would be an incriminating thing against you. Different cases have gone different ways on this. So it's still an open question. I think we talked about it on our Colorado Grandmothers for 200 episode way back when, which was episode 120 of This Week in Law. And I think we've talked about it since too. But this is the most recent decision. And what was found there is if it would, in fact, aid the case against you to order you to decrypt the drives, you can successfully invoke the Fifth Amendment and say, no, I'm not going to do that. Evan, do you think this was a proper outcome?
I guess the first observation I would want to make is I think it's great that the Fifth Amendment these days is being used both by child porn suspects and the lawyers for Prenda Law. Don't you love that? this is a kind of a nuanced analysis of the Fifth Amendment, the protection against self-incrimination. And I don't have any illusions that I understand precisely what is going on in these types of cases. But it certainly is an important issue. And the point seems to be that there is a distinction between just having to turn over your password for the sake of letting the government know what you have and turning over the password as an act of a kind of a nonverbal testamentary act of giving the government reason to know that it actually is your stuff. And so the analysis kind of depends on that distinction there. So when we think about these things, I think we need to be cautious and recognize that it's a much more subtle question than whether or not it's a violation of one's Fifth Amendment rights to have the cops say, hey, hand me over your password so that I can see what is on your hard drive here. The cases that have presented these things have some kind of unique facts, like there was the one with the Border Patrol agent who had actually already seen the child porn allegedly on the defendant's hard drive, and so that was not a Fifth Amendment concern, versus the situations where it was in Colorado where we'd talked about that case a couple of times, Fricasso, I think is what the case is called.
Yes,
where
that's right.
The question of having to turn over the information that the government really only had an inkling of an idea that information might be there. So the analysis depends on that, but it's very subtle and certainly of increasing relevance to us, not only with hard drives, but also whether law enforcement could be able to access our smartphones and thereby be have access to things that aren't even necessarily just on that device. So it's a question that probably won't go away soon.
Jason, do you think this matters that it's a federal court that made this decision?
Well, it's child porn, so it's going to be a federal court. Mm-hmm. I actually worked in the child porn department for the AG's office. And, we didn't really deal with this issue all that much, but if he's claiming, if he's invoking the Fifth, why didn't he just identify the hard drives that were supposedly his and those that weren't? Mm-hmm. I think it's a bad decision. Mm-hmm. If he's got nothing to hide, let's just take a look. It's no different than when, there was one case where we worked, where he kept all the hard drives in a safe in his, his apartment. And he had to give over the combination. It was either that or the government would, blow it apart to get into it. There's no Fifth Amendment right. You can't just put something behind a lock and then say, whatever's in that room, I'm pleading the Fifth on. I don't think it's good. So,
right. I mean, the I guess to to draw the real world analogy, you would have, there would have to be a credible argument to be made on the defendant's part that I don't have anything to do with that locked room. That locked room is not in my control. I have no access to it. You know, it's probably easier to do that with a hard drive, easier to make that argument with a hard drive than it is with a physical space. But I think the analogy is a good one. And what do you think, Marty?
Well, again, this isn't my field, so I get to ask you guys, but I was wondering, I mean, did you say that he's not going to indicate whether or not he knows the password, because to indicate that he knows the password is to testify against himself that he owns that hard drive? Is that, was that his argument?
I think that sums it up well enough. I haven't read the papers,
So the bodies may or may not be in the storage locker. So you ask me, do I have the key to that storage locker? And I say, I don't even have to answer that question as to whether I have the key to the storage locker, because to do so would be testifying against myself.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It's putting it on law enforcement, I guess, to find the key.
What other ways does law enforcement have to determine the ownership of these hard drives? I mean, are we talking about virtual servers on an ISP's computer, or are we talking about a hard drive that's found in the possession of the defendant?
These sound like physical hard drives.
And now, I hope, and I trust that was more than a rhetorical question, right, Marty? Because, I mean, there would be all kinds of independent ways of verifying someone's ownership of a piece of hardware rather than having them, you know, narc on themselves. The receipt mm-hmm. from CompUSA might be a good way to start, matching up the serial number to the hard drive to the receipt.
I'm just puzzling through this. I'm like a little bit puzzled. So, in other words, if the law enforcement said, wait, we actually have proven through other ways that this is your hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to tell us what the password is, you're no longer testifying as to whether you own it. We've established that you own it. So then doesn't this become something like a court-ordered DNA swab or something? It's
That would be a Fourth Amendment issue, wouldn't it? I mean, I think the right metaphor would be you're in the interrogation room as a defendant, and the bad cop comes in and says, we have evidence that you killed the victim. Did you kill him? I don't have to answer that under the Fifth Amendment. I could plead the Fifth Amendment. That would just be the same thing. They could come in and say, we have independent evidence that you own this hard drive. We have the receipt from CompUSA. Tell us what the password is. And me answering that would be the same as answering, you know, yes or no to did I kill him? Does that break down in your analysis?
Let's go back to the storage locker. We've established that this is your storage locker. We see that key in your pocket. Give us the key. No, I'm not going to give you the key.
I think if the key's in your pocket, that's a different situation than
the password's in his head.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that difference I don't see. We know we've established that it's his hard drive. We've established that it's his account. We're now saying we're compelling you to tell us the password so that we can enter. We're compelling you to give us the key to the storage locker so that we can enter. You're no longer testifying against yourself as to whether or not it's your storage locker or whether it's your hard drive. It's just a question of you have some physical impediment or a virtual impediment to us obtaining evidence that we've established a probable cause to obtain.
So what does Jason, our former AG, think?
Never an AG.
Okay.
Giving me more credit than I'm due. I think Marty's dead on with this. If in the case of the storage locker, if the defendant doesn't want to turn over the key, then the police just get a warrant and they cut that lock themselves.
Right.
He's not testifying against himself. That's why I was curious as to why he didn't identify certain hard drives as being his and others not, given that they were all found within his apartment. If these aren't your hard drives, well, then whose are they? it will go prosecute them, not you.
Right. Well, Judge William E. Callahan, who was the federal district judge who ruled on this, called it a close call, and I think this discussion illustrates why. So I think that we'll continue to see courts split on this issue. And for folks looking for guidance, just know that the Fifth Amendment's in play here, but it's, you know, no guarantee. Let's move on. Oh, before we do, this Sue has suggested a great first MCLE passphrase for the show, and that is hack in the box after the conference in Amsterdam. So if you're listening to this show for MCLE credit, and you have to demonstrate to any kind of body that you have listened, the first thing you should tell them is the first passphrase for this show was hack in the box. I'll drop another one in a little bit later on. We also have some sponsors to thank, and we may as well take a break here to thank the first of our sponsors for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is ShareFile by Citrix. You know, it's not only what we do at work, but how we do it that makes the difference. I think this show demonstrates that on each and every episode, that how you do your work makes a lot of difference to your legal future, for sure. Our flow of information needs to be ongoing, collaborative, and time efficient, whether we're working at the office or on the go. ShareFile helps you do all that easily and securely. ShareFile by Citrix seamlessly integrates into your daily routine no matter where you are from any mobile device. With ShareFile, files of almost any size are sent as secure links. Notifications are sent to you when they're opened to track their progress. Files can be protected by password for ultimate control. Now, of course, the Fifth Amendment may come into play if you need to keep those passwords to yourself, but you can password protect them and at least put that barrier in place. Plus, you can set up shared folders for easy collaboration with clients and coworkers. ShareFile will change the way you work. To help you get started, I have a special 30-day free trial offer with no obligation, and you'll see the difference right away. So to get that special offer, go to ShareFile.com today. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, we have a bunch of good copyright stories to discuss, so let's get to them. Thank you for that added sound effect. So much good stuff to talk about on the copyright front. One of these stories I cannot believe actually happened. It's we're a little too late for April Fools, so it can't be unreal. Fox really, really did decide that Cory Doctorow's novel Homeland was something related to the Homeland TV show and sent DMCA takedown notices demanding that files that amounted to Cory's Creative Commons licensed and freely distributed novel be taken down and removed from Google. Cory obviously is upset about this and doubly so, not just that it happened and that, you know, this means of distribution that he's chosen to get his novel out there may be interfered with because of Fox's either ill will or confusion. But there's really not that much you can do about it, unfortunately, under the DMCA. It's a very bad illustration. A graphic illustration of how the notice and takedown procedures, when you find yourself in the situation of being subjected to an erroneous or a fraudulent one, that there's really not too much recourse for you. All Fox really has to say is, whoops, we made a mistake. And there's really no way to go after them for having done this. So a tragic person to have this happen to. The ironies here are about three levels deep. If anyone's going to try and get recourse for this, it's Cory, but I just don't know, you know, how much there is that he'll be able to make out of it. Evan, what did you think when you read this?
Oh, come on. It's not a tragedy, is it? Don't you think we should reserve that term for such a...
All right. Yes, maybe I threw around the word tragedy a little loosely.
Poor Cory Doctorow. Nobody's going to pay attention to him anymore because Fox sent a takedown to us. Now everybody's going to forget about him and he will languish in obscurity forever. I mean, I see the point. Sure. And yeah, it is ironic that it happened to Cory Doctorow, and which is an indication that it probably happens to thousands of other people. But I'm sure the content will be put up. And it's just you know, it's a small point in the argument of how the DMCA is an imperfect system here. So, yeah, it'd been nice if it hadn't happened. And, you know, poor Fox. This is the second time we've lambasted them in the last month, you know, because they were responsible for the Jane Hat brouhaha, you know, that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. So what is it with Fox? I guess, you know, Bill O'Reilly is probably telling them to do all this stuff. That's it.
Denise.
Yes, go right ahead.
What makes you say that Fox actually decided that Cory Doctorow's novel was infringing their rights?
Well, somebody made some kind of decision in sending this takedown notice, or are you suggesting that it was just an automated catch for the term Homeland?
Okay. I don't represent Fox. I represent people who have lots of problems on the various websites, and they have to generate a lot of DMCA notices. Mm-hmm. Now, as a disclaimer, I'm on your side on this. You know, something inconvenient happened, and there isn't a good remedy. Right. So if I had to guess, I would say that Fox has to have some ungodly number of DMCAs every day because they have a lot of properties that get infringed. And someone was using some kind of automated system, because the DMCA notices are going to be the same for the most part. You know, that one plaintiff is going to send out several hundred in a day, and they're all going to say the same thing. I swear that I own the copyright in this, and I swear that this URL infringes, and it goes out.
Don't you find that problematic? That they have to swear under penalty of perjury the same way the Prenda lawyers do.
let's get to the better issue. So yeah. I've been on the show before, and I'm a big believer in notice and takedown, and I'm a big believer in expedited dispute resolution. And when I hear these stories, I would rather that this is arguments for a better DMCA and not no DMCA at all. And yes, I know it'd be really hard and expensive to tweak the DMCA in this direction. So I know that, but I'm optimistic. So the problem here is I believe that Fox could easily establish it can plead gross negligence. So here's the problem. The problem is that there is a penalty, even though the letter says, I swear that I own this copyright, and I swear that your action infringes my copyright. And if I sign that letter by mistake, because I wasn't careful and I didn't see that this was Cory Doctorow's Homeland novel, which had nothing to do with my Homeland TV show, that's gross negligence. And the way that the courts have been interpreting the counter notice or the penalty for a bad faith takedown notice is that there has to be intentionality. There has to be intentional bad faith. And if Fox sets up a system that's fast, cheap, and dumb, that's gross negligence at best, the way these cases are coming down. That's the problem. And that's the hard solution. And that's why Cory Doctorow probably won't get a remedy out of this. I was thinking, what could he do? Could he go into a state court and say that Fox is harming me through gross negligence, that this is some kind of business tort, that they're negligently, you know, costing me money? And I'm afraid that what would occur is that the Federal Copyright Act would preempt. And then they look at the case law and they'd say, no, this is just rank stupidity. This is not deliberate bad faith. That's the problem. And still, maybe not tragic, just a problem.
Yes. Well, Virgil suggested a better word, and that is travesty. And I agree that the fact that I think anytime you have to attest to something under the penalty of perjury, and it's possible to be wrong. The reason for that language, the reason that we have people swear, is to make them be really careful. And there should be some teeth in it if you haven't been really careful. I don't think that companies like Fox should be able to have fast, dumb systems that can make mistakes like this without any recourse. I think it misses the spirit and letter of the law to be able to serve notices like this with those attestations and not have any recourse for it. I think, you know, that's a whiff on what the law intended.
So I absolutely agree with you. You made an absolutely correct point, and that is the failing of the courts to have interpreted the bad faith provision in the way that they have. And I also agree with one of your viewers who just wrote saying, isn't the intentionality or the bad faith intentionality inherent if you set up that sort of system? So I say to your reader, bravo, that's a really good argument. And it's a colorable argument. I'm just afraid that it'd be very difficult to ever prove to get the Fox executive on the stand who said, I designed a really inexpensive system for bad faith reasons. That's just a very difficult proof. It's probably the truth, and it's probably impossible to prove.
So there we go, Corey. We're going to have all kinds of discovery into emails and look for that smoking gun about how this system is intended to operate. And maybe that gets us somewhere. what do you think, Jason?
I think, you know, I agree that the problem is that when mistakes are made, it's the little guy who doesn't have any recourse. You know, ideally, what I would suggest would be applying reversal of fees in the Copyright Act to situations like this. And, you know, if possible, taking the courts out altogether, where if the person who receives the notice can prove, hey, this is my content, I was sent this, you know, wrongfully, and then some administrative office then goes back to Fox News and says, okay, well, you owe this guy, you have to pay a fine of like $750 or something. Because, I mean, to be fair, they have so much content. Cheap and dumb is probably going to be the best way for them to enforce it. You know, it's the return on investment issue. If they pay too much attention to detail and everything, now it's costing them money rather than protecting it. That's my two cents.
Right. Scott Michaud has a couple of good comments in IRC. First, he coined the term foxing, which I think will make our second MCLE pass for phrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And second, we're going to talk about copyright reform in just a minute here. And he points out that if we're going to have this gross negligence provision, there need to be some definite damages attached to it. That if you're grossly negligent in letting these things go out, there has to be some kind of consequence. So maybe we could take a look at the DMCA. Who knows what people have in mind in Washington when they talk about copyright reform, but that does seem to be something that's getting some conversation these days, and we'll look at that a little more closely in a minute here. Evan, what do you think?
My mind was just kind of wondering, getting kind of maybe paranoid, that another thing that could happen if a person signs a DMCA takedown notice, you know, you're swearing under penalty of perjury that's true. If it turns out to be not true, could the U.S. attorney bring a cause of action for perjury? Mm-hmm. You know, an independent criminal proceeding. Again, this would never happen. Well, I guess Aaron Swartz was prosecuted. But you know, I was looking up Title 18, Section 1621 about perjury, and the standard there is willfulness, willfully subscribing to something as true when you don't believe it is true. And that's different than the standard that's actually in the DMCA. So I'm wondering how that would actually turn out if a U.S. attorney brought a criminal prosecution for perjury and, you know, against someone who, sent a incorrect DMCA takedown notice. That's all I was doing right then. Otherwise, my mind was in the clouds.
Yeah. And how would you translate willful, do you think? Conscious?
different than what the DMCA says, because the DMCA says has to be a knowing material misrepresentation. So I'm not quite sure how, I don't have enough of a criminal law background to articulate, those different mens rea, but, they are different. And I'm sure that different facts and different indicators would go to establishing either one of those. As to how to do that, I don't know. I would have to ask somebody smarter.
Thank you, Evan.
That's why we asked you to be here.
Yes. Jason, can you help us?
What was the question?
Yeah, let's just move on. Let's move on to something Jason does know a whole lot about, and we've alluded to a couple of times in the show. And that is this whole series of Prenda lawsuits all over the country. This actually has kind of been unfolding in the background of my mind. I have not really been paying too close attention. But something has happened recently in the San Francisco case, I think it is, involving salt marshes. So why don't we start at the beginning, Jason, and sort of give people the Prenda overview and then tell us where we are now.
Wow. We could actually have a whole episode on this.
Yes.
But in a nutshell, Prenda at first represented, porn companies, none of the major ones, and they've graduated since then to creating their own clients and suing people on behalf of those clients, and it's come back to haunt them. I shouldn't say haunt them, because it seemingly has no effect whatsoever on their confidence in themselves or what they're doing as being right. So that's the overview. But yeah, Salt Marsh, this was good. Salt Marsh was represented in California. You have to sign an ADR statement. And some of them were signed by an individual, Salt Marsh. Then later, in a separate deposition, Paul Hansmeier says, well, the owner is Mark Lutz. The name of the trust may or may not be Salt Marsh. I don't know, even though I'm its corporate representative. We've been able to establish that Salt Marsh, that there's actually a person named Anthony Saltmarsh, who is Jamie Steele's live-in boyfriend, Jamie being the sister of John, who's a partner in Prenda.
This is just too much. If someone's looking for Hollywood, it's this series of cases.
Yeah. What is done now? Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, we should point out that if there had to be a name for a porno lawyer, it would be John Steele. Go ahead. Don't mind me. Continue. Yes.
Perfect.
But yeah, since that time, I think it was a case in Georgia. Yes, Patel, where Lutz furnished an affidavit because of the hammering they've been getting in California, saying that, my name is Mark Lutz, I'm the owner, and Salt Marsh is a trust, and the undefined beneficiaries of the trust are the children I don't have, but may have at some point in the future. And,
great.
This is one of the things that they do, is when holes get pointed out to them, they're always responding. There's never any proffer of this supposed evidence at the time the issues are being raised. It's after it's become a big deal, and then they go back and draft whatever document they feel covers their ass and submit that.
So the upshot is these guys have brought tons of suits, basically trying to extort people to keep their names out of legal papers associated with porn. They've had some success with that. They've done some very, as if that weren't shady enough, they've done some other shady things like trying to convince defendants to allow themselves to be sued to so that they could then use that pending lawsuit as a springboard to bring discovery and other information against supposed co-conspirators. The courts are starting to lose patience with these folks, and things are hitting the fan. Well, how are they or aren't they?
Prenda, yes and no. They just changed their name. You know, whenever they really start to run into problems, they undergo an identity shift, and they'll find new people to serve as the fronts. First it was Steel Hansmeyer, then it was Prenda Law, then it was Anti-Piracy Law Group. Now it's the Paul Duffy Law Group. In our experience, unless you make a court aware of this, all this procedural and background history, which typically isn't relevant to a case, but in these cases, you spend at least two or three pages just saying, this is who the plaintiff is.
Mm-hmm.
You're
directly involved in some of these cases?
Oh,
are
yeah.
you representing parties?
Yes.
Lots of them?
I represent Alan Cooper and Paul Gottfried.
Oh.
That's a good one. Anthony Smith, who was in the Lightspeed case. That was a good one. Uh-huh. You know, they'll recast the claims as computer fraud and abuse or conversion, and they'll file them in state court instead. Or they'll seek out states that have bill inequities and just, you know, get as much information that way.
Right. Haven't some courts been going after them for the substantive lack of anything in their claims, that they're alleging things like computer fraud and abuse, or, you know, that they're alleging things like infringement that they're unable to demonstrate, and the courts are now starting to go after their pleadings for alleging things that just can't be established? I thought I read something about that.
To any extent that has happened, it's been in California.
Mm-hmm.
The Lightspeed case in Illinois was computer fraud and abuse. They couldn't mm-hmm. identify the computers. They couldn't identify where they were. They couldn't identify anything. It's all these vague accusations. And, you know, we got all the way to a discovery scheduling conference before they voluntarily dismissed, which is part and parcel of what they do. Whenever they start to run into serious opposition or they feel they've milked it for as long as they can, they dismiss this case. They walk away unscathed. And all these people who have hired attorneys and whatnot, you know, they're left footing the bill for something that was never really going to be prosecuted. And, you know, as Steele said in Forbes, hey, we've made at least $15 million off of this.
Wow. Evan, do you have any Illinois lawyer take on this?
I've represented probably 25 or 30 defendants who've been sued by Steele, Hansmeyer, Duffy and company in their mm-hmm. various iterations. And, you know, I'll speak carefully because these guys sue people for defamation too.
Yeah, they certainly do.
I first met Steele back in 2010, so going on 3 years ago, and I've hung out with him. We had lunch one day, and you know, went out for drinks another afternoon. And he's a really interesting character. The first few of these matters, unlike Jason and his firm, I just settled these on behalf of my clients, you know, for various reasons. We didn't, fight any of these things too hard, because for whatever reason, we settled out most of these things. But you know, when I first met John, you know, I could talk to him, and you know, like I said, we hung out, and it was interesting to get to know him. And he didn't have quite the public persona yet as being a troll. This was before Nate Anderson and others really started profiling him on Ars Technica and kind of painting a more public picture. And the last conversation I had with John was in 2013. You know, maybe a couple months or so ago. This is where I got to really be careful, I guess. All I can say is that it seemed like I was talking to a different person. You know, the results of the conversations that I had with him, the most recent conversations, just did not present themselves with any issue resolution that was, in my opinion, nearly as rationally arrived at as the earlier conversations I had with him when I first met him. So there's something interesting and something intriguing that has been going on for sure, which is borne out by the types of things that have been happening that are coming to light here. So my firsthand perspective of this happening has been interesting. That's for sure.
So you're saying there at one point was some reasonable discussion around making the cases go away and that they have dug in and become more intransigent?
Well, the conversations more recently were comprised of much more assertions and statements and attitudes and postures that seemed more tangential to the real merits of getting to the case. I'm serious. I don't want to say too much because I'm afraid the guy will sue me for defamation. So,
right.
You know, you can kind of hear me characterizing it in ways so that I feel safe. Just, I guess what I can really say is just like really talking to an entirely different person on a human level, just like, you know, something really has changed in him in the last 3 years.
All right. Interesting. So, Marty, any thoughts on this Prenda debacle?
Yeah, well, just talking about the larger problem about these BitTorrent suits and trolling. First off, by the way, there are copyrighted works which are being infringed by swarms, and it is difficult to find out who they are. So there can be legitimate BitTorrent copyright infringement cases. Having said that, there is a scam, and I think in the show notes we talk about how these scams work, in which the person says to somebody, well, look, I'll give you an example. Someone calls me up. And first off, it's unusual that they can call up a lawyer because a lot of the people who are getting caught in these subpoenas are the sort of people who don't interface with lawyers very often. And they get this, and he got a letter, and he said, we have reason to believe from Verizon has told us that someone with your IP address has downloaded the following films, and the films had the sort of titles that you would not want your wife or your family to know that, you know, you were downloading. He's very vehemently denying that he had downloaded these things. And then I had to diplomatically ask, do you have teenagers living in your house? And unfortunately, the answer was yes. To which he immediately says, yeah, but I have open Wi-Fi, so it must have been the neighbors. And these letters are embarrassing, and they give a very low amount. Part of the oddity of these demand letters is that they say, we can get you for $150,000, but we'll be happy to take $3,000 from you. So almost that creates an implication of that you don't really believe in your claim if you're willing to settle out for that amount. And he is someone who has had no experience with the legal system, and I can't really effectively represent someone who's looking at a $3,000 demand. So there's this inherent you know, problem which makes this sort of thing profitable. I mean, you could say it makes enforcing your rights plausible, or you could say that a scheme is now profitable. But we see in the Southern District of New York that the judges are no dummies there, and they're saying, you know, you get this letter, and it basically threatens to say that you've downloaded porn, therefore you should pay this money, and by the way, they say that they'll get you for $150,000 if you bother to defend. We see that there's this inherent uneven playing field here. In the Eastern District of Virginia, they've been very activist, and they are attacking the concept of joinder, which is that, hey, you know, you're saying that these 300 strangers all acted in concert, you know, to download this. You haven't proven that at all. All you've given us is a list of, you know, IP addresses. I was thinking, you know, in preparation for the show, what can we do about this? I know that there's this antipathy towards a party being anonymous, but I wonder if a judge, an activist judge, could say to the plaintiffs, we'll let you get the IP addresses and we will let you send a letter advising them of your rights, but you're also going to have to give them information about access to counsel, and you're going to have to give them copy of the relevant passages that you're bringing your claims on, and you're going to have to identify remedies. And also, you have to tell them that they will be allowed to defend themselves under seal in some way. Like, they're not, they won't be able to hide their identity from anyone. But let's assume they want to put in a defense that can be under seal. I mean, when a large corporation brings litigation, they say that everything that is trade secret, and they're allowed to make a lot of their papers confidential. Why can't the guy who calls me up and is worried that his wife's going to find out stuff, why can't he at least feel that if he defends himself, he can at least the content of the suit in this situation can be under seal? So again, it maybe the judges can go and take some acts to reduce the prevalence of what we're assuming to be meritless copyright trolling.
Well, here's the problem with that is that most courts say, well, if you're a John Doe, you're not a party to the case and you don't have any rights. So the defendants in these cases find themselves in this weird limbo where all these demands are being placed upon them, but they have, you know, in effect, no legal recourse, because technically, according to the courts, they're not parties, even though, you know, you can't file a suit against unknown parties. You'd have to sufficiently identify them. Now, some courts have said, yes, you know, for all intentions, you meant to sue IP address X, and that's who you sued. And if they turn out to be the wrong person, you have to deal with that. But for the most part, John Does have no standing.
Okay, well, let's segue this into a discussion of copyright reform. Since earlier this week, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte, the Republican representative from Virginia, announced that the Judiciary Committee will conduct a comprehensive review of U.S. copyright law over the coming months. This is not the first time we have heard recently that Republicans are interested in taking a look and revamping copyright law. We had Derek Khanna on the show not too long ago, who drafted the memorandum that was leaked, or not leaked, posted, but then later retracted along those lines. And so it's neat to see the House Judiciary Committee paying attention to these issues. But folks are quick to point out that Congressman Goodlatte supported SOPA, co-sponsored CISPA, and is generally considered a copyright maximalist. So, you know, put all that into the mix. I think we already have a couple of bullet points from today's show that we would love to get in front of the House Judiciary Committee as they are considering these issues, such as definite damages for grossly negligent DMCA takedowns. I would add to that that in the face of this Prenda discussion we've been having, the six strikes regime that is now in place should play some kind of role in limiting the ability to bring these kinds of lawsuits. Another good fodder for discussion along these lines is the Groove Shark case that just came down that Professor Eric Goldman wrote about in great detail and lucidity over at Forbes. What happened there is this very strange decision where Groove Shark is only partially eligible for the online safe harbors under the DMCA, and that for some older sound recordings, those safe harbors will not apply, and instead state law will apply. And figuring out in advance what law is going to apply and whether the safe harbor is available for things that might be put on Groove Shark is prohibitive, if not impossible. And I encourage you to go read Professor Goldman's article on this, because he points out three very distinct problems with the decision and its interpretation and application of the DMCA. So, Marty, you want to add to this list other points for copyright reform that we need to be sure the House has in front of it?
Well, first off, I want to second your endorsement of Professor Goldman's article of the Groove Shark case. Mm-hmm. I'll just add my two cents, which is that, as at least as a policy point of view, one of the reasons why we have safe harbors for intermediaries is so that intermediaries cannot independently ascertain the truth or falsity of the claims that are being made to them. So if Fox or whomever says to Groove Shark, I own the federal copyright, we want Groove Shark to say, I don't want to get involved. And now UMG is arguing the exact opposite. We want Groove Shark to suddenly ascertain whether state law covers some of these recordings. So the policy would seem to say, no, let's take Groove Shark out of the equation by giving them the safe harbor. So yes, please read Professor Goldman's article. The point that I had wanted to talk about, and it's under the larger heading of let's have more data, let's have more empirical analysis when we ask these questions. I think I will credit Professor Lessig with being the head of the term limit or copyright reform aspect with regards to whether there should be renewals or shorter terms. And he points out that of the huge body of copyrighted works, most of them are not utilized a very short period of time after they are created. And this week, there was an article in TechDirt, and it referred to an article by Matty Iglesias on Slate, which talked about the diminishing economic value of copyrights. And there's a link to this in the show notes. And they both referred to a chart created by Professor Petrie. So first off, a shout out to Professor Petrie, the author of the only copyright treatise that I think is worthwhile reading. And it showed a chart from 1959. And it asks the question, what percentage of copyrighted works that were created in 1931 were renewed in 1959, which was when under the old regime, we had 28-year renewals. So maybe your audience would like to guess in their heads what some of these percentages were. The only type of work that was above 50% was motion pictures, to which I ascribe the high value of a single copyright in a single movie and the small number of movies in comparison to the number of people who you could have processing copyright renewals. Some forms of copyrighted works created in 1931, single-digit renewals, and music was only something like 27%. So the argument goes, if the overwhelming majority of copyrighted works under the renewal regime were not deemed to be valuable enough to renew, for God's sake, let's go into the public domain. So let's bring renewal back. Let people make this decision with the assumption that a small amount of these works will be renewed, the valuable ones, the Taylor Swift songs will be renewed, and the rest will be free for all of us to use. I should pause a little for that to set in, but I had one problem. Although I absolutely agree with the general thrust, I think that we have a single data point and that's not enough. And this is where we can get into a conversation of the history of popular music. In 1959, how did you look at music from 1931? Compare that to now. 28 years ago was 1985. I know that my kids pay money for music that was created prior to 1985. There are more ways of monetizing oldies. I mean, I know that I listen to the 70s, 80s, and 90s stations on Sirius on my drive to and from work. But I also think that we owe it to Elvis Presley and the Beatles. In other words, we're still in the rock and roll era in a way that 1931 and 1959 were in different eras. So in other words, I think that the back catalog of music is more valuable, and that if they had to make the decision to renew, they would make they would renew a higher percentage than 27%. Other than that quibble, I think that we should really focus on this, that music, most copyrighted works lose their value, the majority of their monetary value, in the first 28 years of their life, even with Sirius. And that maybe we should reimpose renewal. The sophisticated, competent companies will still be able to renew their catalog, and will have the benefits of a lot of works entering the public domain.
All right. Wow. I think that's a great bullet point for the House to bear in mind as they consider copyright reform. We're going to continue this copyright reform discussion for a bit longer here with Evan Brown, Marty Schwimmer, and Jason Sweet on This Week in Law, episode 208. But before we do that, we're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode, a new sponsor who we're thrilled to have, and that is ProXPN. Once again, I'm going to point you to Security Now's episode 400, where Steve Gibson took a thorough look at ProXPN, which is also sponsoring his show and some other shows on the network, kicked the tires. And, you know, Steve is our guru for knowing whether things are worthwhile and work as they say they should. And he has given the Steve Gibson Security Now seal of approval to ProXPN, which they've got to be thrilled about because that's a great thing to get. What this is a VPN that you can take with you anywhere. More than ever, your online freedom and privacy are under threat. Governments and ISPs want to control what you can and cannot see while keeping a record of everything you do. Plus, that free Wi-Fi at the coffee house, hotel, and airport is putting you at risk because your passwords and sensitive data can be intercepted more easily than you might think. What was that sheep program, Evan, that you referenced
Fire
earlier?
Sheep.
Fire sheep. Fire exactly. Sheep, exactly. Yeah. I've mentioned the Six Strikes program in connection with our copyright reform discussion here and how that went into effect in February. You might remember that we talked back then about an interview that Cyrus Farivar did. He's over at Ars Technica with Charlie Douglas, a Comcast spokesperson, about the ins and outs of the Six Strikes program, how it would work. And Cyrus asked whether Six Strikes would be able to see a potential violation if the user was using a VPN. And Charlie Douglas, the Comcast spokesperson, said, "I think they would not. I think you're right that they would not be able to see what was going on." So ProXPN is one such solution that can protect your activities online, whatever they may be. It's a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel, and Steve talks a lot about how that works, through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, your email, file sharing, and instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. You have, with ProXPN, complete online privacy through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You choose which one. You can protect yourself against your ISP's Six Strike rule. You can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites. You can bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the United States, the UK, Asia, and more. ProXPN's software for Windows and Mac offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. ProXPN also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. No app required. There's world-class customer support. As I mentioned, Steve Gibson gave it a great review, so go check it out on episode 400 of Security Now. And also go to proxpm.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year. We've got a special offer. Use the code TWIL, T-W-I-L, and you'll get 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code TWIL. We thank ProXPN for their support of This Week in Law, and we really hope that you'll go check it out. Let us know what you think of ProXPN. All right, guys, back to copyright reform. Evan, you haven't weighed in on this yet.
Wow. I mean, there was a ton in what Marty was talking about, and it was very densely packed in a very typical Marty Schwimmer kind of way, full of erudite, valuable commentary. You know, the point, just to bring us back up to speed after that ad, was, Marty, if I'm hearing you right and characterizing you right, you know, we were looking at this 1959 chart from Professor Patry's book that shows a very low percentage of works that were renewed after the 28-year initial term of copyright expired under the 1909 Act. And you were, I think, using that as a as an argument to show that the renewal scheme is a good thing for allowing more works to fall back in the public domain. So maybe I should pause there and ask you, Marty, did I characterize that correctly, at least what you were saying?
Absolutely.
Yes. So then the quibble that you had with that, I think there's a ton of really interesting things to talk about with this, because I agree with you here that the quibble that you took was that the music renewal rate, which came in on this chart at 35%, you know, in 1959, 35% of the works that had gone into copyright and were initially registered in 1931 were renewed. And you're suggesting that that rate might be higher now. So just to kind of quibble with the data a little bit, that is really interesting, because it I think presents us the questions to examine both from a cultural standpoint and a technological standpoint, how we consume this content and the according or corresponding importance or relevance that we put on that content in our lives. You were saying that, you know, people now, kids now, I think everybody now consumes a lot of content that is older than 28 years old. And that may not have been the case in 1959. You know, I guess the question would be, would Elvis Presley, teenage Elvis Presley fans in 1959 cared all that much about Hoagie Carmichael? Might be another way of answering the question. I have no idea. Who knows what things were like in 1959. but, you know, these days we care greatly about I can't believe I was just getting ready to say something like we care greatly about Def Leppard, but maybe we can think of all kinds of examples. Like we care greatly about Soft Cell or Thompson Twins, or gosh, we could go on and on just naming, you know, wacky stuff from the mid 80s, you name it there. So, but is it so much, and I don't think this is an either or, I think this is probably a both and it just all is kind of this interesting admixture of an observation of culture and technology and the symbiotic effects of all this stuff. You know, we perhaps are broader now in our appreciation of culture. We like more music from the 80s and, you know, mid 80s and before, or whatever 28 years ago was and before. But also we have the technological means to consume more content from larger periods of time. I mean, in 1959, if you wanted to listen to a Hoagie Carmichael recording, you'd have to go get the Victrola out and dust off the thick, out-of-date format records. I'm sure there was also plenty of current vinyl that had Hoagie Carmichael recordings in 1959. But now, if you want to consume content from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, you can download thousands of those recordings onto a device that fits in our shirt pocket. So it's just it's incredible to think of the differences, perhaps, that are influencing this quibble that you're having, Marty, which I think is fascinating and is right on, whether those result from culture or technology or some admixture of both. And I guess the interesting thing would go is, you know, is that such a difference in magnitude that it becomes a different in kind that it would, oh my gosh, counterweigh so much that maybe, you know, maybe the copyright copyright period should be long. Maybe it should be, you know, a really long period of time. I don't want to be too exuberant in, you know, observing this quibble because maybe it would undermine the initial premise that copyright terms should be shorter and renewals should be the standard way of going forward. Really interesting stuff.
Go ahead, Jason.
That was me, actually. I don't want to two more cents
in. We do
in.
Look alike.
It's true. I just want to say that I still want to make the point that we need more empirical data. I'm all in favor of charts and studies and things like that rather than platitudes like, oh, we need copyright to encourage creativity. I'm all for data as long as the data is not, you know, skewed in some horrible way. I agree with Evan. I think there's two different things. I think it's the market has changed that now I have Sirius radio that I can listen to in my car. So technology allows us to consume more culture in general. And I think it's cultural. That's why I was trying to drag us into the conversation. And I see that many of the people on IRC are now tweeting their favorite bands. I saw a reference to Come On Eileen, which I'd like to sing now if you don't mind. No, but my point
I don't think
was
we have
that,
the license.
Well, it would be a parody.
Singing it, it would.
Quite transformative, that's for sure.
Be that as it may, as I said, we're still in the rock era. So I think that actually kind of changes the value we place on somewhat dated content. So I just wanted to get that in. And one more thing. Thank you for mentioning the Thompson Twins. I'd now like to sing Hold Me Now.
Now, if you mash those two up, we've really got something there. All right, before we get too silly here, I want to stress that although there has been a good deal of online skepticism about Congressman Goodlatte leading the charge for copyright reform, here's what he said in making this announcement on Intellectual Property Day 2 days ago. World Intellectual Property Day, I believe it was. The internet has enabled copyright owners to make available their works to consumers around the world, but also has enabled others to do so without any compensation for copyright owners. Efforts to digitize our history so that all have access to it face questions about copyright ownership by those who are hard, if not impossible, to locate. There are concerns about statutory license and damage mechanisms. Yeah, there are. Federal judges are forced to make decisions using laws that are difficult to apply today. Even the Copyright Office itself faces challenges in meeting the growing needs of its customers, the American public. All good thoughts. So more power to him. I think, you know, that hopefully he's getting the kind of good information and suggestions that are available in Professor Goldman's article that we've referenced about the Groove Shark case, the other points that we've raised here today. Jason, do you want to pile on to this list at all?
The only comment I would add would be that there are still a lot of works that have not been re-released, that there's often, you know, what happens is, I mean, I just came from the record store before the show. There are still thousands upon thousands of albums and content that's never been re-released, especially in digital format. And oftentimes, the only way someone has to get a hold of these is to download a copy that someone put up online. You know, they bought the record and they burned it. Or, you know, they go out and they drop, you know, for some of these albums, you know, you can drop like 1,600. I have, you know, at home alone, I have two that are like $1,800.
So you're a big vinyl fan? You have a lot of vinyl then?
I got like 3,000.
Wow.
Which is that's like a small collection compared to some. But, you know, if you're talking like a lot of the jazz albums from the 50s, you know, and you throw in Blue Note, I mean, those are going to go for at least $1,000 a pop. You know, so it's sometimes the only way to access this content is to infringe, unfortunately, because it's not available anywhere else. I don't know if that adds anything.
I think it does. I mean, you know, I think it underscores Congressman Goodlatte's comment that, you know, our cultural history is being threatened by the limitations of copyright law. And Evan, you've talked a lot about that on the show recently as well. Evan, I'll leave any final thoughts on this to you before we move on.
No, just always interesting, you know, how this, you know, I love it when we can bring these concepts of cultural heritage, cultural history, our human society, all these things. It's so interesting to see how intellectual property law can affect that. And so the stakes couldn't be higher.
Yes. And we mentioned World Intellectual Property Day. There was a day yesterday was World Malaria Day. And Padre SJ reminded me that May 1st is Law Day in the U.S. at any rate. And on Law Day is when we recognize that equality under the law has made America a beacon to other nations. This is coming from an American Bar Association website. It is a pledge clearly set forth in the Declaration of Independence and in the opening words of the preamble of the Constitution. This is the 150th anniversary of the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. So Law Day 2013 is a great opportunity to explore the movement for civil and human rights in America and the impact it has had on promoting the idea of equality under the law. So that's coming up for us too. Let's move from the sublime to the ridiculous. And another trademark and in this particular instance, right of publicity issue. And that is the opening credits of Mad Men. And the fact that in that pastiche of 1960s era brands and images that Don Draper falls past in the opening credits is a picture of a then model, now 79-year-old Gita Hall May, who is suing Lionsgate over the fact that her image from a Richard Avedon photo shoot more than half century ago, and our friend Eric Gardner wrote this up, of course, at the Hollywood Reporter Esquire. He's been following this lawsuit since it was filed. It's, I think, super interesting that this momentary glimpse of Gita Hall May has resulted in a suit against Lionsgate. I think it's also super interesting that Lionsgate finds itself, you know, as Hollywood sometimes does these days, in the seat of arguing for fair use and free use of our cultural history, including all the imagery in this montage. Marty, there are tons of trademarks in there. Do you think that Lionsgate is going to prevail here?
There's a lot of cases where the fleeting image cases where there's not much of a case here. No. The person, right of publicity is pretty hard to establish. What was the value of her image being appropriated? She's on the screen, I think, for less than 2 seconds. Compare that to a guy who posed for a photo where he's drinking a cup of coffee. And then 10 years later, he's recognized in the supermarket where the cashier says, "Wait, that's you on the Taster's Choice label." And that turned out to be the case. The Taster's Choice had appropriated his image, and that was a lasting appropriation, and you could have a big monetization. What was it worth to be on that label? And he had, I think a six-figure payout. That is a case that I'd rather have than this case, especially where, I mean, you've pointed out most of the important facts. They transform her image. They put it as part of a larger commentary. I do not believe that the individual is recognizable. I mean, if people said, "Oh my God, that's Marilyn Monroe in that pastiche," maybe there'd be, I picked a bad example because she doesn't have a right of publicity because she was a New York State resident where the right of publicity is not descendable. But if the person had been recognizable, maybe you have a colorable claim. But if she's just floating by as Don Draper is falling past, I'm not excited about her chances. But then again, I don't know all the facts.
All right. Well, let's leave the discussion of this at that, because we're running out of time to bring the show in for a landing. And I don't want to do that without at least touching on the update to Google's trademark policy, the AdWords changes that it has made, and the difference between using someone else's brand as a keyword and using it in AdWords text. Marty, can you briefly bring us up to speed as to what's going on there?
All right. So I am Pepsi, and I purchase Coca-Cola as a keyword. So someone who types in Coke as a search term, I, Pepsi, have paid money so that my sponsored ad can run alongside. Maybe my ad will say Coca-Cola, which would be trademark infringement. Maybe it would say cheaper than Coke or better than Coke. That would be comparative advertising. Or maybe it will say Pepsi. Are you thirsty? Try Pepsi. All right. Mm-hmm. So that's the spectrum of possibilities. What these cases are now pretty much solidly in agreement. Among the things that Pepsi hasn't done wrong is the mere act of buying Coke as a keyword. So Google has no liability in selling Coke as a keyword. There could still be a problem if Pepsi were to say confusingly similar text in the ad, but the mere act, the sale of Coke as a keyword to someone other than Coke, is not going to be a cause of action.
Right, and Google, in their terms and information for trademark owners, has said since 2006, we're not even going to investigate. You can file a complaint about your issues with your trademarks being used in people's AdWords text, but we're just not even going to look into other people buying your trademark as a keyword. Marty, you did say that one of those things would be trademark infringement. Which one was it?
Well, if I were Pepsi and my ad merely said, I am Coke, and you click through and it led to Pepsi's website. I mean, I pick competitors. Obviously, they would never do anything like that.
No.
But counterfeiters might.
Gotcha. Yes, a counterfeiter might. All right. Well, that the policy, I guess, has now been expanded as Google introduces AdWords into more global markets. And what it's done recently is just normalize its policies around the world. So competitors can now buy one another's trademarks as keywords in China, for example. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, if you want to get sociological about this, what this is really ratifying is that, and I think Professor Goleman should be credited as a leading advocate of making this observation a commonplace, which is that people use a brand as a navigator. If I'm searching for a digital camera, I might not necessarily type in digital camera as my search term. I might type in Sony as a search term, and I'm willing to look at any particular brand. So Google's policy ratifies and the law ratifies that this is okay, that there is no proprietary interest in the fact that people will look for digital cameras by going into a store and asking for a Sony, or typing into Google Sony. So that's the holding.
Gotcha. Any thoughts from you, Jason or Evan?
I would just say it's comparable to when you go onto Amazon. Even if you put in a specific product name, down at the bottom it says, you know, people who looked at this also looked at these other cameras by, you know, competitors. So yeah, I agree with Marty 100%.
All right. So let's move on to our tip and resources of the week. Our tip has to do with sort of a follow-up on a story from a while back where Reed Hastings of Netflix posted on his public Facebook page, some information that related to the finances of the company, the future direction of the company, and numbers about how many downloads I think they had done was what was involved. He was proud and just sort of tooting the company's horn. And the SEC, rather than getting involved and saying, hey, you know, that's the kind of disclosure to shareholders that needs to be made in certain regulated ways that don't involve Facebook at this point, instead of coming down on Netflix or Reed Hastings, actually issued some rules recently enabling companies to use social media to make these kinds of disclosures, as long as they get the word out that investors should look to, for example, Reed Hastings' public Facebook page for this kind of information. So companies, you know, have now gotten the blessing from the SEC to do this. I guess lawyers in that sphere are a little bit hesitant about advising companies how to do it. They would have liked the SEC to be more clear about what exactly companies need to do to make disclosures that will make the SEC happy. But nevertheless, it is a possibility. So if you are a company that is publicly traded and you have executives who like to use social media, definitely this is an option for you now under the SEC. This was written up over at law.com by Joshua Sisko. And my actual favorite part of this article is that the previous guidance on this was issued in 2008, at which point Joshua said, the SEC issued guidance in 2008 on how companies can disclose information on their websites in compliance with Reg FD, but then in 2008 could not have possibly anticipated what shape that would take today. Which, we're talking about what all the kids are doing. I think in 2008, Twitter was 2 years old. Facebook was definitely older than that. And I think maybe they could possibly have anticipated some of this stuff back then. But I don't know. We are talking about the SEC. So that is
when
our tip.
When I'm driving around these days in my flying car, thinking about the good old days of 2008, you know, before I could telepathically communicate with you without uttering a word, I wax nostalgic.
How did we live back then? I do not know. All right, we have a couple of great resources. One is from the Sunlight Foundation, folks. It is called Churnalism, and it is a tool that enables you to check things against a database of press releases and Wikipedia content. The idea is to see if what you're reading has actually been lifted straight from a press release or Wikipedia, or is in fact legitimate news. So it's both a plagiarism identifier and sort of a BS identifier. If someone is putting this out as, independent reporting, you can see, hey, they just lifted that off of Wikipedia. So interesting tool and wonderful thing to have available. It's a web extension for Chrome, Firefox, and IE. And our second resource of the week, I really like. It's a new tool from Fastcase, who we've talked about on the show before. I think we've had folks from Fastcase on the show before. It's called Bad Law Bot, which of course we would have to plug something called Bad Law Bot. And what it is, I love the idea of it. Fastcase is an online research tool where you can go and look up cases and do full text searching, if you're writing briefs or otherwise trying to figure out what the law is on a particular issue. It's a competitor to things like Lexis and Westlaw. And they have 65 million case citations in all of the cases that they have in their database. And what they've done is they've gone ahead and used that data. I call it court sourcing, because one of the things that lawyers have to pay attention to is whether an existing case is still good law, whether it's had negative treatment by other cases who've looked at it and analyzed it and considered it in the context of the decision it had to make. So they've got these 65 million citations, some of which say things like overturned or distinguished, that tells you that there's some issue with this case that's being discussed. So they're leveraging that data, and what the Bad Law Bot does is just tell you if the case you're looking at has had any negative treatment in those 65 million citations. I think it's a cool implementation of sort of big data searching against a large database that they already had. And it's a great way, the people who know best, who do the most thorough analysis of the legitimacy and the logicality of legal reasoning are the courts and their clerks who write up appellate opinions. So you're really leveraging all of their knowledge in looking at whether something has this negative treatment or not. So I like it. I think it's a cool little addition to the fast case arsenal there. Any thoughts on any of this, guys, before we go ahead and wrap the show, Evan?
I would just hate to open up that crowdsourcing ability too much to lawyers, because, you know, then big firms would hire armies of people to go add a bunch of noise to the system and say that a bunch of law was good when it wasn't and that it was when it isn't. And, right. You know, to stymie one's opponent, that would really
yes. kind of I, not, I think not be it's fun. Good they limited it to court sourcing as opposed to lawyer sourcing, because you're right there. The courts don't really have any agenda other than trying to get law right. So
right. And you just can't trust those lawyers on anything.
Yes. Well, someone in IRC was saying every lawyer, when they're sworn in, should have to swear a do no harm oath. And that's not a bad idea. Marty, any thoughts?
I was thinking I would have trouble making a living if I made such a oath. So I don't think that's a good idea at all.
Oh, dear Lord. Zealous advocacy and all. No, Jason?
Thanks. I've actually submitted an application to Prenda Law.
You're back. Good luck with that. Let us know how it goes when you move on over to the dark side. All right. I think with that, we will go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law, which has been really fun and informative. Thank you so much for joining us again, Jason.
No problem. Love it.
Great. Anything you want to, other than your various Prenda activities, you want to let us know anything else that's going on with Boost Suite or yourself in the near future that people should pay attention to?
Well, I can tell you that we did do some work on Boston's Finest. When we first got involved, it was Boston Blue, which airs on TNT, I believe. Yeah, and we're handling the defamation cases. You know, we got a lot of Prenda-centric stuff, but we have other things out there as well, a lot of software, BitTorrent litigation as well. So that's what I've been up to. I don't know what Dan does. He's not in today.
Always a good idea to keep an eye on your partners.
Hopefully he'll let you know that before too long, and that you'll keep in touch and let us know what's going on with you. I enjoy hearing you're great about sending me heads up to things when they happen in your area of practice. So I really enjoy that, and I hope you'll keep it up.
Glad to.
Marty, always wonderful to chat with you. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me. And I might as well plug the Twitter feed @trademarkblog.
Right. Now, if I were John Stewart or perhaps Bill Maher and we had an after the show we could go to, that's when we would have you sing to your heart's content.
Should have warned me. Let me get iTunes fired up here.
All right. Yes. Yeah, stay tuned. And Evan, wonderful to chat with you again. I missed you last week.
Yeah, same here. Same here. Really enjoyed our conversation this week. You know, always very fascinating to talk to you, Marty. And Jason, really enjoyed your insight, especially the kind of the frontline stories about the Prenda Law stuff. So very interesting perspective. So Denise, yeah, great time. Looking forward to next week.
Yes, not to mention frontline perspective on what happened in Boston recently. So thank you so much. Or Cambridge. It's not the same, right? Folks in Cambridge get...
Cambridge is just over the river. So they lived in Cambridge, but they... bombed Boston.
Yes. All right. Well, here's hoping things are much more quiet in your neck of the woods in the near and long term. And thanks everyone for joining us this week on This Week in Law. You can catch the show every Friday. We record at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. Our discussion points are available for your perusal. And please let me know what you want added to upcoming week's shows. You can check them out at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw. Each episode has its own URL. So this one's /208. We've also got a Facebook page, Google Plus page, a Twitter page, but I mostly, that's mostly just letting you know when the new shows are available. Evan and I are where you should go on Twitter if you're looking for what we're up to. He's at Internet Cases. I'm D. Howell. Definitely hit us up in all of those spots. Let us know what's on your mind, what you'd love to hear us discuss. If you're confused or interested in the very interesting areas of technology and the law. We'll see you next time on This Week in Law.